it's nice to be with you. Things are wrapping up. I've got a few hours left here. What I'm hoping with this is really to make it more a Q&A, things that you want to talk about. Now, I have an itinerary that I was given, and on that, I was asked to speak on current research. So, maybe I'll just briefly talk about some of the things that I'm working on. I've got a lot of projects in the fire. I mean, the Polanyi Center that I was heading at Baylor folded, I became a research professor, that was actually one of my titles, and so I became only a research professor, which means that I only do research. I don't have any teaching duties, and so I've got a lot of time on my hands, and what I do with that is mainly write, and I do a lot of writing. So I've got actually about, seven book projects under contract, and another one that I'm getting off the ground. A lot of these are edited collections. Edited collections are pretty easy to get done quickly. You basically get other people to do the work for you, and then you just put it together, put your name on it, and you get the credit. So but I've got a few there, and they can be quite useful. I mean, there's a little book people have asked me, what's sort of the best general introduction to intelligent design? And if you look in the bookstore, there's a book, Signs of Intelligence, and that was basically a special issue that I did for Touchstone magazine, and then I added an introduction and added another essay to it. But it's a nice general introduction, user-friendly articles. I asked most of the contributors to write as they would for First Things. So, not a lot of scholarly appurtenances, try to just keep it simple, no heavy footnoting or anything like that. And so that's a real nice introduction. You have lots of lots of the main players in the intelligent design movement are there. Well, I'm working on a few other edited collections. The big one, which I think is going to get reviewed pretty widely, probably make it into the New York Times, is one that I'm editing with Michael Ruse. Michael Ruse is a well-known Darwinist, and we actually got this accepted at Cambridge University Press. And we got seven that went through. There were eight referees that Cambridge got, because I think it was just so controversial. They wanted to make absolutely sure that the people signed off on it. And so seven were totally positive. And then there was another review which was very grudging, thinking that it was a bad idea to be dignifying these intelligent design crazies, at Cambridge University Press. But they did add that the book would sell well. So, so that was, so that book is titled Debating Design from Darwin to DNA. And that all should be coming out next year. It's got four sections or parts with about four contributors to each part. There's a Darwinism section, a self-organizational section. So these are people who are critical of Darwinism but also don't buy intelligent design, or taking a naturalistic approach, but see that self-organizational laws of some sort are going to be important in accounting for biological complexity. Then you've got theistic evolutionists, Richard Swinburne, Keith Ward are contributing to that section, John Polkinghorne, and then the final section is on intelligent design. So it'll be a nice volume. You get a full sweep of the spectrum of perspectives on it. There's another collection I'm editing for Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which is titled Uncommon Dissent, D-I-S-S-E-N-T. Now, the notion within Darwinism is that there's this great tree of life, and that's called common descent, that everything descends back to a last universal common ancestor. And so this is a play on that. And so we've got what I'm trying to do is get people who have not been involved in the intelligent design movement to come forward, put their necks on the chopping block, and declare for intelligent design. So there's some interesting articles in there. There are a few retreads, pieces that have appeared before. David Berlinsky's piece and commentary, The Deniable Darwin, which created a firestorm at that journal about 6 years ago. That's going to be the final piece. That elicited about 25 letters, and those were published in the following issue. And so I'll be publishing some of those of noted Darwinists who criticized him, and then also his responses. The one person who has not consented to be published, to have his letter republished, is Richard Dawkins, the arch atheist at Oxford University. And I think that's in part because he had actually contacted me by email some years back, and so we had a correspondence, and I think I thoroughly irritated him with a little puff piece I wrote called Evolutionary Logic. If you do a Google search on evolutionary logic, that comes up now as number one. But it's a little piece where I go through all these different arguments that evolutionists use, like the argument by demonization, the argument by obscure reference. And then he, in one of his New York Times essays, said that anybody who disbelieves in Darwinism is either ignorant, stupid, wicked, or insane. So I have the argument by removable ignorance, the argument by stupidity, the argument from wickedness, and you know the idea. Anyway, so I don't think he was all that pleased with it. But because he is not permitting his little letter to be published, I will summarize it and also indicate to the readership that that I'm summarizing it because he didn't want to have it included. So I think he'll enjoy that. Anyway. We have what fun we can with this. But so that's that'll be coming out with Intercollegiate Studies Institute also probably next year. Two books that I'm writing. One is a follow-up to the Intelligent Design book with InterVarsity Press, titling it The Design Revolution. And basically, it's a question and answer book. It'll have about 50 questions or objections to intelligent design. And it's just, you know, when I'm debating and talking about these questions. I mean, this is a very friendly audience, but often I feel like I'm a Kafka character just being smothered by red tape, you know, trying to get out from under it. And so all these objections that people raise, and so this will be a book to try to really really deal with a lot of the objections that are raised against intelligent design. They come from all quarters. I mean, it's philosophical objections, theological objections, why intelligent design makes for bad theology, you know, which to me is somewhat surprising because it seems that it's such a minimal scientific program. You know, and anyway, so that's what that book is going to be about. The subtitle is Answering the Toughest Questions About Intelligent Design. Hope to get that wrapped up soon. The thing is, I haven't been able to do any work on it because the project, which has really been taking a lot of my time lately, is a sequel to a book called Of Pandas and People. This is an intelligent design supplemental text, which was used by high school students and also college students. It's about, the thing is, it's dated. The second edition came out in 93, but there was only extremely small changes from the 89 edition, so it's about 15 years old. And it'll be retitled, and most of the book is new. It's been just totally updated, new chapters. There's some of the old material is there, probably about 40% of it is old material, but even that was changed quite a bit. And then Michael Behe and Jonathan Wells are coming on as authors with it. So this should really create a stir because I think it's one of the things we really need is curriculum materials. And so this will serve in that direction. You know, we'll see what happens with that book. I mean, thing is the pattern has been with groups like the ACLU or the National Center for Science Education, or as one colleague of mine calls it, the National Center for Selling Evolution. The way they're in there immediately intimidating school boards and teachers, you know, threatening them with lawsuits if they teach this stuff. And it'll be interesting to see what happens with that book. And then some of the other things I'm working on. There's a collection of patristic writings on creation ex nihilo, and design that I'm working on with a friend of mine. That's been in cold storage for a while, but that's going to be coming out. There's a book on sort of the metaphysics of intelligent design. If you think of information as something, as a real entity, where you've got communication between a sender and a receiver, it can lead to a notion of communion, you know, and being as communion, a relational ontology. And so that's something I want to develop. And let's see, there are a few other things. I've got a collection of Polanyi writings. So Michael Polanyi, Freeing Inquiry from Ideology. That'll be coming out with InterVarsity Press. And I think there's still one other thing. So, you know, as I said, edited collections are usually pretty easy to do, but the books, actually writing, that all take a lot of time. So those are the writing projects. And part of this, I mean, you know, I've got the time, and part of this is also just trying to get the material out there, get a critical mass going. Talked to Phil Johnson years ago, said, you know, even if you have the best book on, you know, refuting Darwinism, it's still not going to win the day, because what they'll do is, if it's, you know, if it, let's say it is the perfect refutation, they'll ignore the book for a year or two, and then they'll say, you know, as was argued in that widely dismissed book, you know, they'll just dismiss it. You know, it's so you have to keep the pressure on, and so that's one of the motivations for publishing so much in the way of books. I like books because there's a sense of permanence there. You know, if you've got to have a journal article or something, it's much harder to refer to it. It puts the arguments out there in a way that people have to deal with it. Also, I find that even the turnaround time for getting a book out is, if you can get it written, that is faster than some journals. I mean, you know, it just takes forever sometimes to get things published. I think I had a piece with Zygon which took about 3 years from the time I approached the editor till it finally came out. So those are some of the writing projects. I've also got some more, I mean, technical things that I'm working on, and one mathematical treatment, developing information theory, which I'd like to get published either with an online journal that I do or with a mainstream complexity journal. And then I'm also now in touch with some people in the business school at Baylor. It turns out that there's been so much conflict with my being there that I'm basically shut out from the philosophy department. I mean, I never get any communications in terms of, you know, in being invited to colloquia or anything like that, which would be my natural home. So I'm, and I've been told by the administration that they would like me to be at Baylor, but if that's going to happen, I need to win friends and influence people at some department, and thereby, you know, get accepted onto a faculty. That was really the problem with my going there, that I had no departmental base, and as a result, when the biologists and Darwinists started, going crazy about the Polanyi Center, I was in a, you know, I just didn't have any support structures there. And the administration was under such pressure that they didn't feel that they could support me. So through that time. So I'm now working with some business professors on organizational theory, organizational change, because evolutionary theory is involved in characterizing the change in organizations. And intelligent design has an angle on that, because intelligent design, among other things, is a theory of technological evolution. It's how do technologies change, you know, and they tend to change in three ways. I'm simplifying here, but one of the themes there is that when technologies evolve, there can be incremental changes, generational changes, and revolutionary changes. Think of the telephone. You know, telephone is a revolutionary change. You know, communication now, voice communication is possible over distances. Once the telephone is on the scene, there's small incremental changes. You may go from a pulse to a dial, from a pulse to a touch tone phone, but that's a small incremental change. Then you get a generational change where you go from standard sort of wired phone to wireless communications. So those sorts of changes, you know, by the way, I also see them in biology, but they come up in technological evolution, and then, you know, and that's a concern in organizational change. And then you can also look at organizations themselves and how they change. So anyway, those are some of the things I'm working on. I'm a problem solver. I like to get my hands into things and try these ideas. I wouldn't mind actually making it big time in the business world, having an infomercial here and there, you know, and then, you know, being able to leave the academy just, you know, as sort of the intelligent design, you know, Anthony, what is it, Robbins or whatever, you know, so we'll see about that. But the thing is, there's actually method to the madness, because the biological community is very resistant to these ideas of intelligent design. I think it's going to be I think we're making progress. I think there's good research that's going to be coming out. I mean, that's in the pipeline right now. That's, I think, really going to throw them for a loop. But even so, I think that you've got some powers that are very entrenched, you know. And unlike the business world, in the academic world, I mean, these, you know, you have your tenure, you're entrenched, you don't have to change, you know. Whereas in the business world, if something works, you know, then you're going to go with it. So if these models of organizational change based on technological evolution and intelligent design can actually make a difference in the business world, I think it can indirectly do a lot to further intelligent design, because it's like, hey, you've tried using these Darwinian methods to characterize organizational change. They're not really working. We've got some much better ideas here. And so I'm hoping that there'll be some sort of transference. So these are some of the things I'm working on. So if you want to ask about that or just anything that's really come up in the last day and a half, or anything that's on your mind about intelligent design, ask away. Yeah. Well, I think when, I'd like to get the reference for Pinnock's stuff. You're talking Clark. I mean, okay, because there's a Rob Pinnock who is not at all a fan of intelligent design. But yeah, I think that they're using probabilities in somewhat different ways. I mean, I think when Behe is talking about it, he's saying, you know, he's looking at the probability of certain material mechanisms producing certain biological systems. I mean, I think that's the sort of probability. So it's like flipping a coin. You know, I've given this example now. You know, you flip a coin several times, you know, what's the probability that you're going to get, you know, so many heads in a row, you know? And if you have enough people flipping coins, then, you know, somebody's going to, you know, if you have 100,000 people flipping coins, you know, there's going to be a good likelihood that somebody's going to get 17 heads in a row. If you've got 1,000,000 people flipping coins, you know, there's a good probability that somebody's going to get heads, you know, 20 heads in a row. So the thing is, those are objectively given probabilities that depend on, you know, the way material objects are operating according to certain dynamical laws and whatever. You know, I mean, it's those you can get those out of, you know, presumably ultimately they'll reduce to some sorts of laws of physics and chemistry. But then I think there's a question of, well, what is the probability of this theory being true? You know, and I think that's the sense in which Pinnock seems to, from, you know, I haven't read it, but, you know, and this is an approach which some philosophers of religion use. I mean, it's more a Bayesian approach to probabilities where they characterize degrees of belief, and I think that's what you mean by probabilism. And I don't think intelligent design is committed to that. You know, I think it's more, well, look, you know, we need probabilities to do science. You know, there's no way around it. Let's do some probabilistic analysis. What does that show us about certain systems? Now, they have certain features. Those systems with features that have these sorts of probabilistic properties are regularly associated with intelligent causation, you know, and so there's an inference that's drawn. It's a probabilistic inference, a scientific inference, but then, you know, then I think you still have to at some point make a judgment and say, well, you know, and I believe that these systems are designed, you know, and now I'm going to, you know, on the basis of that evidence, hold that there is design, and now conduct my scientific research according to that. But you know, it seems that you don't need to then associate a probabilism with that conclusion of design. You could just say, you know, it could be a firm decision, you know, to accept that view, as opposed to saying, well, you know, I assign this degree of subjective belief to design being correct. You know, does that help at all, or is, you know, or is, because I don't think you're going to get around probabilities in, you know, in scientific theorizing. I mean, they come up, you know, I mean, because there will be probabilities that, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, in my talk, I think yesterday evening, you know, there's a probability that all the fast-moving air molecules could converge on me suddenly, and I could go up in a puff of smoke. You know, I could spontaneously combust. I mean, that's a probability. You know, but you know, we don't give those much credence. I mean, actuaries deal in probabilities. You know, there are probabilities that people will have heart attacks and various things will happen to them. You know, and that's a legitimate subject. You know, I mean, subject for inquiry, and we base a lot of our scientific knowledge on such probabilistic understandings. Yeah. I've seen estimates from 12 to 20 billion or so. So I'm not sure. You know, this is fine tuning. You're going to have to make certain assumptions, and then you do your measurements, and I don't have a problem with an old Earth. You know, theologically it's not an issue for me, and the design problems that I'm looking at really are independent of these age considerations. I mean, they, 10 billion years, 20 billion years, a trillion years, it's not going to matter, or 6,000 years. I mean, the design problems are still going to be there. But, if this is a physicist who's working in this area where you can, get preciser estimates on certain measurements. I mean, that may be of great interest to them. You know, it's not what spins my crank. You know, I'd like to see it. So, you know, so you heard it on NPR. Yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
If ID continues to have difficulty breaking into the academic community, could it be the case that free enterprise or independent laboratories could end up being an avenue to get
their views out? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a good question, and the problem though is, you know, getting the funding for such entities. You know, it's just to let you know. I mean, Discovery Institute, of which I'm a part, I'm a fellow there. You know, their annual budget is maybe about $1.2 million, something like that. Now they had a grant. They had put in a grant with a foundation for something like $4.2 million for a lab for one of our people, it was a Cambridge molecular biologist, to do, basically to have about 8 postdocs working with him. And he's doing some dynamite research, you know, he's basically having to do this solo, and just so that he can really ramp up, because right now he's only able to get about one publication done every 2 years. I mean, he's published in the top places, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Journal of Molecular Biology, but, you know, it's just very slow because he has no, basically, I mean, right now he's a discovery fellow, and that's where he's getting his support, but it's, you know, basically a standard salary. But so that's what they were looking for, but this foundation, you know, with the dot-com crisis and all of that, you know, the money wasn't there, and so, you know, the years have gone by, and he still doesn't have that lab. And the problem is, I think, you know, within the Christian community, you know, because that's where I think the money would have to come from. You know, it's not going to come from the National Science Foundation or NIH or NASA or Office of Naval Research. You know, so it's going to have to come from donors who have a vision for this sort of work. And the problem, though, is that this is not the sort of thing that gets people going. You know, I mean, when people give lots of money toward things, you know, it may be an institution where they, you know, get a dorm with your name on it, you know, or you give some money for an evangelistic crusade where you're going to see so many souls saved or something. Now, I don't mean to be crass, but, you know, people like to see closure. They like to see something that their name can be attached to where they can say, oh, here we have something tangible. You know, and with the scientific research, it's just not that way. You don't have a guarantee about the outcome. There's not much you can point to or, you know, take credit for your money. And, and this is, I think, also why think tanks have such a much harder time. I was talking to Al Mohler about this yesterday, you know, about just the attempts of the Christians to break into the secular market, secular marketplace of ideas, you know. And it's think tanks was thought to be a way to go. But the problem is think tanks work on soft money, you know, and it's not like you've got a, as I said, a dorm, you know, or something you can endow or so. You know, it's they go from year to year. You don't have a base of students who can supply tuitions, you know. So it's tough, you know. Because I've been watching this, you know, the sorts of monies that we could use, you know, because there's some key researchers who, you know, I think if they had the funds, they could really ramp up, you know, and get a lot of stuff done and published. But, you know, and it feeds on itself. So you have this guy who's doing terrific research, but because he's by himself, you know, I mean, it's not just that he's by himself. I mean, he was with this lab doing his own stuff. And then he actually had some funding to hire a postdoc, and his lab supervisor refused to let him give that bench space to this person. And then when it became more public that this fellow was involved with intelligent design, his supervisor, who's National Academy of Sciences, very prominent, told him to leave the lab, you know. And so there are just a lot of pressures that way. So it's you know, what you're saying in principle would be great, you know, find somebody who's got the money and is willing to put it out. But, you know, and then, you know, foundations, Christian foundations and other foundations, I mean, Templeton Society, or Templeton Foundation, you know, they're big into science and religion, but, you know, they've made their peace with evolutionary theory. I think by and large, they think that, you know, evolution has gotten it right. It's a great way of understanding, you know, God's unfolding purposes in the world, and you know, why reopen these problems and these issues. So I'm actually one of the few people who are ID proponents who've seen money from them. I got a $100,000 grant a few years back to write a book, and that's one of the things I'm working on. Actually, my book No Free Lunch was half of that, but you know, it was, I think in part I got it because it was an anonymous review process. My name had to be off of it for it to be considered, you know. But it's, Pew Foundation, Lilly Foundation, you know, they don't want to, you know, buck the existing system, you know. It's, they're giving money for, I don't know, it's, a lot of it is, you know, it's not Christian engagement. Intelligent design is engaging the culture. I mean, you know, New York Times does a front page story on Michael Behe and my work on intelligent design by the science editor, not the religion editor, you know, so the stuff is getting out, but a lot of what I'm seeing supported is not actual engagement, because you bring the offense of the gospel in any form, you know, to secular culture, and it's going to create sparks. It's more, you know, talking among ourselves about what it would mean to engage. You know, that's the sort of stuff that gets supported. You know, so you've got, I mean, Templeton Foundation, you know, they give about $30 million a year. Pew Foundation, I think it's $200 million a year. But, you know, where does the stuff go? It never seems to go into our hands, you know. So I see us as, you know, Gideon's band, you know. We just have to make do with what we can. So yeah, if you have any you know, any deep pockets, you let me know. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
Who have been the biggest shapers of your own world?
Oh, you know, I think early on Francis Schaeffer was big. I know that his scholarship, you know, could have, you know, there was more he could have done, but you know, I think that the spirit of the man really went a long way. I mean, I think he had a sense for what were the problems confronting the culture. And then you know, other people I'd read. I mean, Stanley Yockey was actually a very important influence on me. He's praying that I return to the Catholic Church, and he's not at all happy with intelligent design, but. You know, when I say return to the Catholic Church, I was raised nominally Catholic, and he still thinks that was the best best aspect of my Christian experience. You know, when I did not know Christ as a Catholic, but his work was important, I think, in just giving me a sense of what the role of Christianity in the rise of modern science, and then I think cluing me in on some of the issues on scientific realism. That was very important, I think, in my formation early on. There's an Eastern Orthodox theologian, Alexander Schmemann, who wrote a book for The Life of the World, which actually was one of the most important things I've read, just in terms of sort of trying to understand where we are in a secular culture. I mean, that was very good. So these are some of the things, standard things, Chesterton, Lewis, they've been very influential for me. Yeah. 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 Well, I deal with some of these. There's a paper I have online called "Becoming a Discipline Science," and I try to outline what needs to happen for ID to succeed. And I'll deal with things like building a curriculum, a catalog of fundamental facts, where we have list these systems, these irreducibly complex systems, indicate just what the obstacles are, just have them available online, let's say, and then I go through some research themes, of what could lead to an ID research. The thing is, I think one of the things to realize is that a lot of work that's already going on is really ID research. It's not called that. It's when you have an investigator that will manipulate manipulate a genome in certain ways, or do a certain type of what's called a Celex experiment, where you're trying to get a ribozyme, an RNA with certain catalytic properties, and you do that by running what ends up being a genetic algorithm. I mean, it's you're selecting for a certain function. Okay, now that usually that's interpreted as, well, that's an evolutionary process, that you're employing. But in fact, what you're doing is you've got this whole thing programmed. You as the experimenter have selected the function that you're going to be optimizing, and then you run, you set up these pools of random RNAs, and then you select for those which have a certain degree of that catalytic property, and then you multiply those, randomly, generate copies, and then you do that again. You just keep doing it, and then you converge on a ribozyme with optimal catalytic properties. The thing is, that is a design process. There's nothing chance going on there. It's intelligent intervention is going on at all points, in the selection of the function that's being optimized. And so the thing is, often this is interpreted as, look at what natural selection and random variation can do. And it's nothing of the sort. So a lot of what's going on, a friend of mine, Paul Nelson, will say, it would be good if these scientists would put mirrors in their labs to remind themselves that they are there, doing the experiments, putting intelligent input. Nobody does just pure stochastic chemistry, So I think just at that level, but I think the more interesting question is there something that could be uniquely or specifically intelligent design research, which could not be co-opted, by the Darwinians. And I think there, I'm not a biologist, so I see more research themes, things you can be looking at. So it's one of the things I mentioned was teasing apart the effects of intelligent causes from natural causes, applying these design methodologies, seeing, because the effects of history are there in organisms, try to develop that. One of the things that evolutionists tend to do is they try to find these Darwinian pathways, okay? So try to tell an evolutionary story how you got from point A to point B. And I think an interesting question, a design sort of question, is take B, start perturbing and trying to work backwards and showing how hard it is to evolve into and out of, the terminal point. That, I think, promises some interesting results. One of the things Michael Behe has done to to build on his work on irreducible complexity. You know, irreducibly complex system is one which has multiple parts where they're adapted to one another to perform some function. Okay, but what he's doing is he's looking at, I mean, these parts have to be adapted, right? I mean, you know, if you have different engines, maybe a Honda engine, a Chevrolet engine, you know, they might have the same sorts of parts, you know, things which are doing similar functions, you know, maybe a piston, a gasket, various things. Okay, but if you try to take them, you know, indiscriminately, you know, parts from one and from the other, and match them up, okay, so you take a gasket from one, a piston from another, spark plugs from another, try to put it all together, are you going to have a functioning engine? No, well, the parts are not adapted to each other. And so what he's doing is he's perturbing the proteins that are involved in something like bacterial flagellum. He's actually doing this more computationally right now. He can't. Funding for him has dried up, so he's limited to the computer. You know, is that because of his intelligent design interest? You know, it's hard to confirm. You know, but I mean, here's a guy who apparently didn't have problems getting funding before that. Well, so this is one of the things he's doing. What happens when you start perturbing, as it were, the places where different parts join? You know, how much can you do? How sensitive is it? You know, and the system doesn't work. Because if, you know, the idea with evolution is, you know, you should be able to start perturbing, doing slight changes, and thereby gradually getting from point A to point B. You know, and so this is a sort of a question that arises, though, very naturally within intelligent design. Just how tightly are things constrained? How tight are the tolerances? And actually looking into that. You know, so a lot of questions, I would say, that are not just, you know, fit in a design program, but are uniquely design theoretic. And so look at that. If you just type in becoming a discipline science, my name, it'll take you, it's on the web. You know, just when I say type that in, you do a Google search, you know, becoming a discipline science, Dembski, boom, you should find it. Back there. Right. Yeah, I know him. You know, our paths cross quite regularly. I haven't really pursued it with him. You know, it's he holds to common descent. I think it's, you know, I think we in part. You know, I don't think he's committed to it dogmatically. I mean, I think in part it's just a question of picking your battles. And you know, there are two main claims of the Darwin's theory. One is this great tree of life, which is, you know, common descent, going, you know, everything goes back to the last common ancestor. And then the mechanism for how you get that tree. And it's the mechanism that it could be a blind, purposeless process that could account for all the diversity and complexity on that tree of life. That's the real point of contention for Behe. But just how it happens, I mean, I think what he's just speculated on it. I don't think he's gone into it in any detail. I think he's talked about some sort of supercell where all the information is there and it just develops. I mean, I think you can think of it as a developmental model, just as, you know, when the sperm and egg united to form you, you know, you developed. Well, could you have a single cell or some initial organism which has so much information that when it starts developing and proliferating, you get all these different organisms? I mean, you know, it's a conceptual possibility. You know, I don't think there's any evidence for it at this point. I think within a materialistic framework, the Darwinian view and common descent is about all you've got going for you. I mean, it has to be that way. You know, and so you can just, you know, you don't need to fill in the details. But once design is back on the table, it could happen any number of ways. It could happen by common descent. You could have polyphyly, where there are many, you know, different origins of life even, or, you know, different emergences and life at various forms of complexity, metazoans, you know, multi-celled, single-celled. You know, all of these become possibilities, you know. And trying to work through those possibilities, I think, you know, it's, with intelligent design, a lot of questions that have been shelved or were thought to be answered are now back on the table. And because they're on the table and they haven't really been examined, in light of, you know, this enriched set of possibilities that intelligent design offers, we don't know at this point. I think there's a lot, you know, the Darwinist has convinced them, they've convinced themselves that they know the answers to a lot of things when they don't, you know. We at least are willing to admit, you know, we don't know the answer, you know, and that, you know, but that you know, but let's look, so let's re-examine. Yeah. Well, when you say needing billions of years, intelligent design doesn't need billions of years. In fact, there are young Earth creationists who call themselves design theorists. You know, so it's an independent consideration. I mean, the design questions can be posed independently of the age questions. You know, and so, you know, a billion years, a thousand years, I mean, it's really, you know, it's just a few orders of magnitude as far as, you know, from design perspective. So, you know, and so intelligent design, we often will call it a big tent. There are a lot of different people in that tent. So it's an independent question. Now, in terms of intelligent design and its relation to theistic evolution, usually what it means is Darwin got it right, and that's the way God did it. You know, so you take the naturalistic story and you baptize it, and you say that's the way God did it. It's an uneasy marriage. You know, it's artificial. It doesn't have any real theological content or even interest, in my view. Where intelligent design would differ, let's say an intelligent design person who holds to common descent, like Michael Behe, is to say that there is divine guidance or intention, or there's the design involved in that evolutionary process, and that design is detectable. There are places one can point to in the evolution of life. You know, this is now under the assumption, you know, of a full common descent evolution, where design becomes evident, where we can do science, where we can look at structures and say, oh, there's design here. This is where intelligence became manifested. You know, but intelligent design, I think we would distinguish between when intelligence becomes evident, so an epistemological point. I know that there's design in that bacterial flagellum, versus when did that design originate actually in the biological world? Was it, you know, it could have originated just, you know, like that, some sudden infusion of information from outside the system. You know, God says, let there be a flagellum, you know, or it could be that it was programmed in some supercell, or maybe programmed at the Big Bang, you know, so all of those are possibilities. But when, you know, the act of origination is more an ontological point, it's not an epistemological point, and it seems that in biology what we're stuck with is we see these places, these discontinuities where there's novel information, there's something new that suddenly emerges, you know, and we don't seem to be able to trace it back. I mean, think of textual transmissions of manuscripts. You know, we're all theological students here, right? You know, you go look at ancient manuscripts, New Testament, you know, sources, you know. What's the earliest, gospel fragment? You know, I think wasn't there an Oxford papyrus, maybe 75, 85 A.D. with Matthew. You know, and so you can trace back to a certain point. Now, where did that come from? You know, well, that's as far as we can trace it back. You know, it suddenly emerged. Now, presumably, you can trace the story back further. You know, there was presumably Matthew wrote the gospel. You know, and then it was copied, and there was a sequence of copies before we got to that fragment. You know, but that fragment is all we have. That's as far back as we can trace it. You know, so it may be in biology that, you know, we've got the flagellum, and that's as far back as we can trace it. We still have to deal with the information and with the design that's in the flagellum. You know, it may have a further history, but we may never be able to recover it. You know, and history has a way of covering its tracks sometimes. You know, did Julius Caesar have a mole on his, you know, left shoulder? Well, you know, I don't know if history records that, you know, and soft tissue decomposes, so we'll probably never know. Even, you know, I'm not even sure we know where the grave is or any remains for Julius Caesar. But, you know, it's probably something that's lost in the mists of history. You know, I think that's what we're also dealing with in biology. But the design is still evident. Is that helpful, or you want to ask a follow up?
Mm-hmm. And you find maybe a basic type of dog that was the ultimate ancestor of that. Mm-hmm. Still assume mutation and lower of complexity.
Yeah. Well, you never get away. I mean, the Darwinian mechanism does operate. I mean, I don't know of any intelligent design theorist who would say that Darwin got it totally wrong. I mean, the problem is not that Darwin doesn't explain anything; it's that he doesn't explain everything. You know, and this is what the Darwinist wants to say. And for systems like Michael Behe's irreducibly complex systems, that is just the point, that it cannot be simplified in the way that you're suggesting. You know, because if it could be simplified, you know, then presumably Darwinism as a divide and conquer strategy could build up to it. But that's the obstacle that irreducible complexity is supposed to pose for the Darwinian mechanism. You know, it's to block that avenue, you know, to say that the Darwinian mechanism can't do it. What, how are we doing for time? One more question? Yeah. 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 Well, I think, when I first speak to the Christian colleges and universities, I think these ideas are getting play and circulation there. I mean, there's schools I can think of. Biola University certainly seems to be behind intelligent design. There's Palm Beach Atlantic College, which apparently is putting some resources there. So there's interest, you know, and I think there are schools that are getting behind it. Unfortunately, I think what we need is something university level, you know, where you've got the resources of a research university, where you've got reduced teaching, you know, not more than two courses a term, and where people can spend the time, you know, intelligent design researchers can do the research. I think they're promising signs. I think these ideas are getting out there, and you know, in the Christian Academy, and that means that the students who are, you know, studying there and then will go on, hopefully, to careers in science and related fields where they can do intelligent design research, that they'll be making an impact. And so I think it's positive. You know, I'd like to see it go a lot further. You know, now you asked about research funding drying up. I think the people who've been most visible with this, I think we've taken some hits. You know, now I know that there are, you know, I've got colleagues who seem to be doing just fine. You know, I mean, there's a guy named Fritz Schaefer who's in chemistry, computational quantum chemistry. You know, his research is going gangbusters. I mean, he's been up for the Nobel Prize 4 times. There's 900 publications. I mean, it helps to have an entire research lab and be able to put your name on every publication. But still, you know, he's third most cited chemist in the world. You know, he's the star at University of Georgia, and he will give classes or talk about his. He's thorough evangelical Christian. You know, totally upfront about his beliefs, and will, I think, sometimes offer seminars or things on science and Christian belief or science and faith, you know, and the school doesn't bother him. I mean, he is the star there, you know. So you've got people like that. I know a molecular biologist or microbiologist at the University of Idaho who seems to do quite well. I mean, he's got his research funding. Thing is, he's not trying to do, or, you know, or I mean, he sees his stuff as relevant to intelligent design, but he's able to cast it in a way which is non-threatening to the NSF or wherever he's getting his funding. So, you know, there are people who are able, you know, who are design friendly, design proponents, speak at design conferences, who are doing just fine in the academy. But I think it's when you ramp it up, I mean, neither Fritz Schaefer nor this fellow I'm thinking about at University of Idaho have really gone public, have, you know, had their stuff addressed in the New York Times and you know, are getting all this vituperation from the secular establishment. And, you know, I don't know what would happen. I don't think Fritz's funding would dry up. I don't know what would happen with Scott Minnick if suddenly he became very visible. This is the guy at University of Idaho. If he suddenly became very visibly associated with intelligent design. I mean, the thing is, he's been somewhat visible. I mean, he's been at conferences. He's got some great lines in a video called Unlocking the Mystery of Life. You know, by the way, it's a video I'd recommend to all of you. You know, so. You know, I don't want to be conspiratorial about it. You know, I think the problem, I think it's really getting some sort of critical mass where we can get people moving and on board. I mean, there are scientists I talk to. There's a guy at University of Georgia, also a molecular biologist, who wants to do intelligent design research, but I think it's finding, and this comes back to your question, I mean, finding research projects which are specifically ID, you know, I mean, where you're not going to be doing that within a ostensibly Darwinian context. Because I think a lot of what goes on there, as I said, is design research already. But something, you know, this is, I mean, we're at the early stages, and I think we've got to be creative. So I'm, you know, I don't have a sense of inevitability about intelligent design success, because I think it's going to depend. Good ideas are fine, but they need to be worked. They need to be mined. You know, you have to, the workers have to be there. I think very much in terms of what Jesus said about, you know, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. You know, we've got to get the people out there. And yet I think there's a vitality and excitement to these ideas, which I think will carry the day. So, all right. Thank you.